He died in 1980, but he still is the biggest influence on cognitive developmental psychology today. What I want to do is to focus on the strands of work which are most closely related to Piaget, though we will see him crop up really for the regular rest of the course. The terms that are often used are neo-Piagetian, meaning somebody who has revisited Piaget's ideas but with a new accent, or post-Piagetian, meaning that they come after Piaget and they may or may not subscribe to his particular way of looking at things. And I would describe neo-Piagetians, such as the people that I'm going to talk about today, and also Robbie Case and Kurt Fischer, who we'll be talking about later, as holding at least three general interests. One is constructivism, that's the belief that people are not born knowing things, nor do they simply reflect what's in the environment, but rather they have to build up knowledge scheme by scheme, circular reaction by circular reaction, action by action, operation by operation. So constructivism is really the intellectual legacy of Piaget. Second characteristic is that the Piagetians of today are very sympathetic to the notion that kids pass through stages. The term stage is sometimes thought to be a bit politically incorrect, so we now use the term phases. But the general idea is for a certain amount of time, kids have one level of understanding and activity, and then there's a change, a transformation, a modulation, a transmogrification, and then the child is in its subsequent stage or phase. And the third characteristic is a sympathy to domain general mechanisms. Domain general mechanisms are cognitive capacities or skills which are thought to apply to a whole range of materials, a whole range of contents. If you are a domain specificist, or to use the more common term today, a modularist, you believe there's one set of mechanisms to deal with language, another one to deal with visual spatial materials, another one to deal with numbers, and so on. Piaget was a long-sustained argument against that position. Piaget believed if you were at the concrete operational level, if you had certain what he would call groupings or group mechanisms, those should apply to all different kinds of content. Everybody has moved somewhat more to a modular position in the last 25 or 30 years, but Piagetians are still sympathetic to the notion that there must be at least some mechanisms, some operations, some ways of knowing which are across the board, and if you go from one stage or phase to another, that across-the-boardness changes. By far the most prominent American psychologist working in the general Piaget tradition is Jerome Bruner, Jerry Bruner, to those of us who studied with him and who know him. Bruner is 85 years old in the year 2000, but is still a very active researcher, stuns all of us with his energy and creativity. And Bruner was important in bringing both Piaget and Vygotsky to the attention of American scholars, both of them, in fact, in the early 1960s, when Bruner himself was changing from being a quote-unquote adult psychologist, meaning a psychologist who studies primarily adults, to being a developmental psychologist who studies infants and young children. And indeed, we might think of Bruner as being an American synthesis of strong ideas from Piaget, strong ideas from Vygotsky, but put together in an American kind of way. What's an American way? Well, one is to be more of a functionalist than a structuralist. Functionalists, as the name implies, are always asking of any activity or behavior or even mental structure, what's its function? What's it trying to achieve? How does it adapt? What are the consequences of this thing working the way that it does? This comes out of, we might say, the American pragmatic intellectual tradition, both in philosophy and psychology, and in that matter, in figuring out how to survive in the West. And Bruner is much less sympathetic to what we would call a structuralist approach. The structuralist approach both implies that there are mental structures whose constitution can be laid out, and that these structures have a life and a dynamic of their own, rather apart from the particular context or environment in which they are found. This is hopelessly abstract, so let me try to bring it a bit down to earth. If you're a structuralist about language, as, say, Chomsky is or many linguists, you think of language as a system with grammar, with phonology, with semantics, and you lay it out and you study it out and you say, what are the rules for creating grammatical sentences and what are the exceptions and stuff like that, and you're very interested in language as a structure. I wouldn't say Bruner is uninterested in this, but in his own studies, Bruner asks all the time, what is language trying to achieve? He's interested in what are called speech acts. The speech act I'm engaging in now is basically declaring something, and it's a very common speech act for a lecture. But if I say, gee, it's very hot in here, or would you open the window, that's a different kind of speech act. That's a request. If I say to you, I now pronounce you man and wife, and I have the power to do that, that's a very powerful kind of speech act. It's performative. I'm actually creating a legal change in the world simply by uttering certain words in certain contexts. A functionalist is always looking at language in that way. The functionalist is always trying to say, what's this utterance going to achieve? Why is it used? What are the consequences going to be? And doesn't care that much about whether it's grammatical or not. The important thing is that the goal of the language gets used. And this is actually quite helpful in thinking about young kids, because young kids are certainly not grammatical in the way that the accomplished adults are, but they manage to use language in order to achieve what they wanted to achieve. When they don't, they get frustrated and they try something else until they get you to open the window or close the door or shut the light or take them to camp or take them to McDonald's or whatever the request is. So it's not that the functionalist ignores the structure of language. It's not that the structuralist doesn't ask what's language used for. Piaget was certainly interested in the communicative aspects of language and the decentration involved in taking the perspective of another. But wherever he looked at something, Piaget tried to lay out what the abstract algebraic structure was, and that's something that Bruner has said is not very important to himself. Let me run through some of the other defining characteristics of a Brunerian approach, and many of the people who will study in this course, including myself, are loosely speaking Brunerians as much as we are Piagetians or Vygotskians. Bruner, by the way, knew Piaget quite well, but Vygotsky died in 1934 and Bruner did not know him. One interest is an interest in the tools and technologies of a culture, those artifacts which allow us to do things. People are pretty smart even when they're naked, but if you give them a pencil or you give them a hammer or you give them a wheel, they're much smarter, they're much more able to do things, and all of our capacities are amplified by the tools and technology available to us. Cavemen, cave women, did not have very many tools, so they lived a rather brutish and short life. We have fantastic modes of communication and transportation, and these all allow us to adapt much more successfully to our world, to live longer, to have, by argument, more pleasurable life. When we hear the word tool, we usually think in terms of something physical, like a saw or a hammer or a wrench or some other kind of machine that allows us to carry something out, a lever, a balance beam. But what Brunerians or Vygotskians would say is that language is a tool. Other kinds of symbol systems like drawing or numbers are also tools. They allow us to do things. They allow us to carry out functions which are important to us. And whenever tools are invented, they extend what we can achieve as human beings. And what Vygotsky would particularly emphasize is the kinds of things we initially do in the real world with tools, we can eventually do inside our own head. We can internalize them. We can use these tools as part of our mental furniture. This is not an idea that Piaget would oppose. Piaget also thought about actions carried out in the head, but he didn't have this whole cultural, technological bent, which we might say is more of an American and a Soviet idea, what Piaget would call an idea of big countries, rather than an idea of small countries like Switzerland, where he came from. Bruner's effort to create his own theory of cognitive development coalesced in the middle 1960s in a book called Studies in Cognitive Growth, in a number of articles, including at least one that you have on the reading list. And in this work, Bruner argued that young children pass through a set of stages or phases in which they learn to represent the world, to represent knowledge in a number of different ways, which he called an active, iconic, and symbolic. Brunner argued that these things follow in that order. An active representation is the representation of the infant, what Piaget would call sensory motor representation. Iconic representation is the representation of the preschooler, what Piaget might call the semiotic stage, stage of images. And the symbolic stage, the stage of the young school child, the 5, 6, 7, or 8-year-old, is a stage where you can use arbitrary meanings of vehicle. It's like words which have arbitrary meanings or other kinds of marks on a page. This is not a very controversial sequence, but what Brunner claimed was that each of these ways of representing continues. So unlike Piaget, where you sort of get out of the sensory motor stage and become a symbolic or an operational creature, we all remain sensory motor and iconic and symbolic. These are various modes of representation we have available to us. And a lot of cognitive development involves a struggle between one mode of representation and another. When your understanding inactively pushes you in one way, and your understanding iconically or symbolically pushes you another way, then you're in a conflict. And though Piaget also believed in conflict, Brunner made an issue of the conflict between different modes of representation as a motor for cognitive development. So let's take the classic conservation task, conservation of liquid. Brunner reasoned that one of the reasons why youngsters believe that there's more water in the thin, long vessel is because it looks higher. This is an iconic mode of representation. If something has big extent, there must be a lot of it. So if it's flatter in a rounder vessel, there isn't as much of it. What would happen then if you actually did the pouring in front of the child, but you had a screen there, so you could no longer see the water levels? Would the child continue to believe that there was more water in the tall, thin beaker, or would he now have that overridden by his knowledge that nothing has been added or taken away? And indeed, what Brunner found, working with Françoise Franck, was that conservation was much more robust if the iconic mode of representation, how big it looks, was not in competition with your symbolic knowledge, namely that nothing's been added or taken away. In another set of studies, Brunner showed that if kids actually do the pouring themselves, they're more likely to believe the amount of liquid hasn't changed than if somebody else does the pouring. If somebody else is an adult and they're smart and it looks bigger, you're more likely to think that maybe something was really added, there's really more there. But if you do the pouring and you see nothing's been added or subtracted, your active mode of representation will be dominant, according to Brunner, and you will be a conserver. The reaction to Brunner's ideas was not terribly controversial within most of the United States, because it seemed to capture a sequence of events which made a certain amount of sense, that when kids are very young, the way they know the world is through their actions. Then, as it were, they have a more pictorial view of the world, they have images, and those are very dominant, and then they eventually learn to master different kinds of symbolic systems. But my own teacher, Nelson Goodman, argued that there was really not a logical basis for a relationship between iconic and symbolic representation. Goodman's argument, which was a clever philosophical argument, though I don't think it's a particularly convincing psychological argument, was that any two things have a certain amount of similarity to any other two things. So if we say something resembles something else, there are many ways in which it resembles that thing, but it may also differ from it in many kinds of ways. And so he claimed that to assert that certain things look more like one another and had a closer relationship than something that was arbitrary was not a cogent basis in which to make the argument. I think this is something that would be interesting to talk about, the difference between a philosophical argument and a psychological argument. Piaget himself did not particularly comment on Brunner's sequence, which, as I said, was rather similar to his own way of looking at things. But he was very critical of Bruner's dismissal of Piaget's own structure-based account. Piaget really did believe in these mental operations. He really believed they could be laid out and studied and that they controlled the way kids made sense of things. And Piaget believed in the absence of a story of human cognitive structures, human mental structures, you could never give a real explanation of what's happening in a child's behavior. And perhaps the analogy to language is helpful here. Certainly, language allows you to do certain things, a la Bruner and the functionalists, but if you don't have a theory of how language is structured and what makes certain things understandable and other things not understandable, like words, if, fun, through, put in a funny kind of way, as I just tried to do, then you can't really understand how language accomplishes what it wants to. So in the debate between Piaget and Bruner, you really have the limits of a purely functional or a purely structural kind of approach. A few more points about Bruner. Bruner was one of the first developmentalists to focus a lot on the effect of school, the impact of school on children's learning. Piaget overtly said almost nothing about school. And he and Patricia Greenfield in the 1960s went to West Africa and actually compared the performances of kids who went to school with kids who were unschooled or preliterate, kids who didn't have schooling and might never get schooling. And the reason for doing this was to determine what are the impacts of going to school, being in a room, having a teacher talk about things which are not present at the moment, introducing certain kinds of notations, written notations, maps, alphabet, number systems, and so on. All of this was acknowledged by Vygotsky, largely ignored by Piaget, and so left a very large room for Bruner and Brunerians to really investigate the difference that school makes in cognitive development. And I think if one summarizes a huge amount of studies, what they concluded was the very fact of going to school is extremely important. If you aren't in a school, you don't learn how to deal with notations. You don't learn how to take information in from somebody who's discussing something that isn't in front of you, and you're not learning by doing, but rather learning by listening and taking notes. If you're not subjected to that, you have a very different view of the world than if you have been subjected to that. And I think one can take Piaget's studies of adolescence and fault them because Piaget doesn't acknowledge the extent to which the tasks he gives kids, like the mixing chemical tasks or the balance beam tasks, are tasks which are very school tasks and the tasks which kids would probably not be able to approach at all if they hadn't had some years in school. Very recently, Bruner has been focusing on two what he would call very distinct ways of knowing, the narrative way of knowing, which is knowing through stories, through telling people accounts of what happened, describing things, and logical, a causal implicational account where the presence of A and the presence of B causes C to happen, or the presence of A and not B causes C not to happen, that kind of thing. The distinction is important because most of developmental psychology has really focused on children's logical thinking, and that was certainly Piaget's focus. But a lot of our understanding of the world is through stories, through making sense of things by the narrative sequence of a person who has things happen to them and runs into obstacles and devises strategies and achieves or doesn't achieve goals. And that's a way of knowing which Bruner, following Goodman, believes is very important and yet was under-examined in developmental psychology. And consistent to this, in his most recent work, in a book which is coming out at the end of the year 2000, Bruner has worked with a law professor named Anthony Amsterdam at NYU Law School to unravel the nature of reasoning and thinking in the law, particularly the nature of cases and how do cases work in the law, how do arguments get made on the basis of precedent and on the basis of competing rationales which obtain to a particular case. And I mention this both because the foray into law is quite daring. Almost no psychologist has studied the law. It seems to be perhaps too big an issue to take on. And the fact that Bruner, at an age where most of us will long be dead, is continuing to do very original work. I'm going to mention now some of Bruner's major students, We will be revisiting some of these individuals later in the course, but I want to say a word now about several of them. Perhaps I'll first mention Patricia Greenfield, because I've already mentioned her. Patricia was the individual who went with Bruner to West Africa and actually did conservation and other kinds of studies with pre-literate students, and found in those studies that indeed there were significant delays in conservation among students who didn't have a school education, but eventually the major conservations were achieved. She also more recently has been exploring a topic that's very controversial, namely the relationship between language, the acquisition of language, and the ability to carry out certain kinds of acts, such as acts in a sequence, acts where one thing facilitates another, acts where things are nested inside other things, like putting a Russian doll inside a Russian doll, and so on. And contrary to what is, I would say nowadays, the more popular view, but consistent with the kind of view that Piaget would have put forth, Greenfield believes that there are quite intrinsic connections between the things kids can do motorically and actively through a series of actions and the kinds of things which they can do in language. Because in language, you can concatenate things, you can put two clauses together, but you can also create subordination. We have a clause which says since or because. You can also embed things, the girl, that the boy, that the teacher spoke to, talked, etc. Those are all things in language which have analogies in our operation on objects in the physical world. You can see how this is a Piagetian view, because it suggests that rather than being different operations taking place, there's actually an underlying operation which yields sets of behaviors in the world of action and relationships among clauses or phrases in the world of language. So that is Patricia Greenfield, who teaches at UCLA in Los Angeles. A second set of people to mention, Michael Cole and Sylvia Scribner, also became involved in cross-cultural studies in the Brunnerian tradition. And they examined in particular what it meant to acquire different kinds of literate systems. And these ranged from literate systems like the ones we have in English, where kids learn to read and write the language and to express themselves using the language, to what happens when you learn a language like Hebrew, just to be able to read it and to memorize passages, or Arabic, where you may learn to read and memorize large parts of the Quran, but you aren't able to use that language in your daily life. And what they were interested in was whether exposure to literate system per se produced cognitive differences, or whether you actually had to be able to use the language to accomplish things in your own world, as you could with English or French, but not with Hebrew or Arabic, unless you actually learned to use those languages functionally, in Bruner's terms. And what Scribner and Cole found was, in fact, mastering a script without being able to use it functionally did not have powerful cognitive consequences. This is consistent with the notion that if you go to school, what you learn in school has to be something that's useful to you, not something that you simply memorize but you can't put to any kind of use. And if you learn to use material in school, if you learn to use your literacy, that has a much wider effect on how you think and reason. The person who has developed this the furthest is David Olson. David Olson is a professor in Toronto at the Ontario Institute for the Studies in Education, and he has been exploring the idea that our whole understanding of the world changes when we're able to put the world on a piece of paper. That the fact that in literate cultures you learn to write about things, and you can read that writing and you can read the writing of other people, really transforms your entire cognitive system. This is a very bold claim, and I think it's one that has a lot of power to it. If you do not have literacy, you're very unlikely to have any kind of distance from language. Language is simply being used to accomplish certain things. You may not even have a sense of what a word is, because a word, after all, is a written entity. It's not an entity in speech. What's the difference between a word and a phrase? They come out very quickly. Unless you have a sense of what a word is, you can't really answer that kind of question. Also, there are all sorts of things that print allows you to do, like to establish what it is exactly that somebody said, or to report somebody said to somebody, somebody said something to somebody, and to footnote the source of it and so on. These are all things which at best are difficult and often in the real world are impossible without a literacy. There's no way really of establishing what somebody said if you couldn't write it down, because people have different memories of things, and how can you tell one memory from another if you haven't been able to write it down? This, of course, is before the stage of tape recorders where you can actually go back and listen. But that's not something that human beings evolved to be able to do. Anyway, Olson's general argument is that various kinds of symbols and systems in media, such as literacy, each involve certain kinds of intelligence. And to make sense of the world on paper develops a whole set of cognitive capacities which people would be very unlikely to develop if they didn't have a literate system. Olson goes even further. He says that if you live in a literate household, even before you learn about reading and writing, you already have some of this way of thinking. And indeed, I've observed in the children of academics who have not learned how to read and write yet, they will talk about the difference between what somebody said and what they meant, and they will argue about belief systems, so-and-so believed this and didn't believe that. And these are all ways of thinking and talking which would be very unlikely to develop in kids if they didn't have literate adults around them. And probably one of the reasons why kids who come from literate families have an easier time learning to read, for the most part, is because they already have been introduced into this world of making sense of things on paper, whereas it's a big mystery to individuals who live in the unschooled world what it means to sit down and to make little marks, and that, or even more dramatically, to be able to look at little marks, and anybody who looks at those marks can make the same kind of sense out of them. So I hope you see in Olson a Brunnerian and Vygotskian turn more than the Piagetian one, namely that there's an interest in tools and technology, in this case the tool of written language, language which you actually write with a quill or with a pencil or on a word processor, and the mental skills that you need to make sense of those tools, and the fact that you will develop those tools in cultures which have schools and people who can teach literacies. It's a very different world from the world of Piaget. The world of Piaget ignores schools, ignores literacies, sees even language basically as an epiphenomenon overlying the most important structures, which are structures of thinking, and those structures of thinking don't come primarily from tools and technologies. They come from acting on objects and from reflecting on one's own actions on those objects. Very, very different flavor of things, and the way of thinking we're trying to develop in this course, when you take a look at an example and you say, well, how would Brunner have thought about this? How would Vygotsky have thought about this? How would Olson have thought about this? What is the perspective each of them brings to bear in making sense of an enigmatic child's behavior? Final of the Brunnerian students on this particular overhead are individuals who've developed particular theories in the Piaget tradition. Kurt Fischer, who will be speaking in this course, has developed the notion of skill theory, which is often called a neo-Piagetian theory. Robbie Case, about whom I will lecture in a couple of weeks, developed another kind of neo-Piagetian theory, which is based upon how people solve various kinds of problems and use executive actions to achieve goals which they've set in front of them. And then a third approach, which I call the simple systems approach, one that I've been involved with along with David Olson, David Feldman, and some other people whose names may not be David, and we'll talk about that toward the end of the course. Piaget, of course, lived in Geneva for his entire adult life, though he did teach in Paris and did travel a lot in the later parts of his life. But while these American Piagetian branches were developing in the 60s and 70s and thereafter, there was also work going on in Geneva, which I would like to mention. Piaget's longest-running associates, Bearbell Inhelder, who worked with Piaget for almost 50 years, in the 1960s and 70s, began a shift, which Piaget certainly was involved with, toward a focus on more functionalist kinds of issues. What strategies do individuals use? What processes they use in making sense of things? Something which takes a look at the various steps that are being carried out when a child is solving a problem and asks why the child doing this at a particular period of time. And this is something which happens over and over again in science. Namely, a person, in this case Piaget and Inhelder, get criticized for not paying enough attention to what goes on a moment-to-moment basis, what the purpose is, what's being achieved, what the strategies are being used, and so on. And usually they're first defensive, but then they go out and try to do studies like that themselves because they realize that there is some merit to the criticism, and they want to, in Piagetian's terms, be able to assimilate that criticism to the already existing Piaget structure. And that's what Inhelder did, together with Annette Karmeloff-Smith, who I'll discuss in a minute. Piaget himself became more sympathetic in the later years of his life, the last decade or so, to the knowledge, to the idea that perhaps knowledge is to some extent domain specific, that maybe it's not the case that all operations apply across the board, but rather that they may be specific spheres or domains of expertise where kids have quite highly developed structures or operations which can't be found or manifest in other kinds of domains. And Inhelder joined him in that shift. The other person to mention, Mimi St. Clair de Zwart, was an individual who was trained in linguistics, unlike most of the people in the Piaget circle. And she did some studies which were designed to bolster Piaget's notion that rather than language driving thought, or language having independent life from thought, two very common views among scholars, that actually, as Piaget argued, thinking, the operations of which we are capable, are the things which advance language. And the kind of thing she showed was that when kids became capable of carrying out certain Piaget operations, for example, appreciating that you could shift the shape of something without affecting its weight, or you could shift the appearance of liquid without affecting its amount, the amount of liquid, that this would also be reflected in how the kids used words like more, less, bigger, smaller, and so on. And the argument was that until the child understood in terms of actions the relationship between shifting something in appearance and actually changing the amount in it, they would not be able to use words like more, much, little appropriately. And so she showed that there was in fact a change in children's language following upon their achievement of a new kind of operational sophistication, such as conservation. I note here two other names, Worf and Greenfield. Worf is the very famous American linguist who argued, and this argument seems never to die, that language actually does influence the way we think. It's the Eskimos have 92 kinds of words for snow, and so the world looks different to them than we who do only have one or two words for snow. And Greenfield's notion that language and action are both marching to the same drummer rather than language being dragged along by action and thought, as Piaget or St. Clair de Zwart would assert. I want now to spend a little bit more time on the neo or post-Piagetian who I think has made the most genuine advances in Piaget's thinking, and that's Annette Karmeloff-Smith, a British-Swiss, and if you recognize her name, Russian scholar, now teaching in the University of London. Karmeloff-Smith was actually a student of Piaget in a way that Karmeloff-Smith and St. Clair de Zwart, the way that Inhelder and St. Clair de Zwart were, but not the major Americans whom I mentioned. As she worked with Piaget in the 60s, she was one of the very few people, and perhaps the only woman, who would argue with Piaget. And when that happens, one or two things can happen. Either you get kicked out or you get respected. Well, in Karmeloff-Smith's case, Piaget respected her very much. I think he knew that she was one of the few people who understood his theory very deeply, deeply enough that she could see the problems in it. People like Piaget tend to be surrounded by lackeys or by individuals who hide their disagreements because they don't want to be rejected by the master, but for whatever reason, Karmeloff-Smith didn't suffer from that problem. And so while she jokingly always called him le patron, the boss, she didn't have any qualms about taking issue with him. And I think her work is, in a sense, the greatest tribute to Piaget, because, in a sense, it says not what would Piaget's students have carried on after he's gone, which are probably trying to imitate the master, the boss, but rather if Piaget had had an extra 50 years and was young again, what might he have done? And I would say the major problem with Komarov Smith's ideas is that they're complicated. They don't lend themselves to easy summary, not in lecture, or in text. I looked up Komarov Smith, a number of textbooks, and she's rarely mentioned because she doesn't have three stages that can be easily described or three terms which can be easily defined. So she's not made for GRE psych exams. She's made for serious students of psychology. Anyway, let me make an effort and encourage you to read her. She's a clear writer, but not an easy writer. First of all, Komarov Smith is interested in things which are, at first glance, very different from another. Meta-procedures, it's a big word for what's a person's overall orientation towards something they do, like recognizing there's a problem that needs to be solved and asking what resources one has, being metacognitive, so to speak. And then microsteps, what happens in great detail, even in excruciating detail, when you are playing with blocks or learning with language or learning how to draw something or make a map or master notation. And a very nice part of her work, which I admire tremendously, is she's always looking at a whole range of different spheres or domains. She doesn't just work on language or just work on drawings or just work on blocks. She works on all of them, and so she's always saying, what's distinctive about each of these areas? Do they have their own procedures and their own steps? And what's consistent? So whether they're working with blocks or language or drawings or notation or theory of mind, to mention five things that she looks at, what's in common? And a second point about Komarov Smith is that she states and concedes that Piaget's most general stage theory can't be correct. This is the sensory motor preoperational concrete formal. That it's just too messy. It may have been great 50 years ago, but it doesn't work anymore. And in general, she is suspicious of the notion of any kind of general stages. She's one of the people who prefers to use the word phase. And she, in fact, talks about three phases of representation, which I'll get to in a moment. Rather than taking extreme positions on the chief intellectual issues of our period, and in this case, she probably is somewhat faithful to Piaget, who loved to always put himself in the middle of a dispute, Komarov Smith is not a domain generalist nor a domain specificist. Rather, she argues that there are certain things which may be quite domain general. She thinks, for example, that there are new representational capacities which come into being around the age of 18 months and maybe again around the age of 4. But she's also very open to the fact that there are certain things which might be quite specific to language or to visual spatial processing or to music or to mathematics, or to understanding other people's mind, and there's no point in trying to argue that these procedures cut across various domains. So she gives credence both to some domain general operations or understandings and things which are quite specific to domains. Similarly, she is not an anti-modularist or pro-modularist. As she says in her very good book, she's beyond modularity, and by that she means that some things start out modular, maybe like hearing certain sounds in language or seeing certain differences in visual sphere, but then become less modular. They become more flexible. They can be connected to other things. They become freer. So this is from strong modularity to weak or absent modularity. But at the same time, she says that some things become more modular, by which she means that there's some fairly general capacities of young kids, but as people become more expert in area and know what they can do much more completely, then these things become more modular in the sense that they're tightly connected. If you start a sequence, it plays itself out and doesn't have any particular connection to anything else. So she is, we might say, quite flexible both on the issue of domain generality and on the issue of modularity, and I think she's probably right. though I have to say at the same time, science sometimes advances more when people take very strong pro or anti positions. But that's how science advances. It's not the same as what makes science correct. In the work of hers that's gotten the most attention and is most likely to get into the textbook, Carmeloff Smith makes the interesting argument that whenever an individual is working with something new, learning how to work with blocks, learning language, learning to draw, learning to make notations. She writes about mastering a Rubik's Cube, learning how to play an arpeggio on the piano, any kind of fairly detailed, intricate activity that individuals go through a number of forms of representation, number of forms, ways of making sense in their mind of what's going on. And what happens over the course of development, she calls RR, representational redescription, namely, the one form of representation you had, which has worked well enough but isn't adequate for new challenges, gets redescribed so you have a more adequate form of representation. And that goes on for a while, and then it gets redescribed again, and you have an even more comprehensive form of description, a more adequate form of representation. And the nice thing about this is it's a phase or stage theory, but it has nothing to do with ages. It has to do with experience and expertise. And so even if you're 50 and you know everything, if you've never done a jigsaw puzzle before, you will go through these phases. I describe the phases very succinctly here as being bottom-up or data-driven, top-down or theory-driven, and then more explicit and more conscious when you actually can think flexibly about what you're doing and be in control of how you go about doing it. I'm going to just try this out right now. Let's take a Rubik's Cube. When you, Rubik's Cube, you know, are these cubes which you futz around with until you get them to be aligned with all one color on one side and all one, another color on another side. They're frightfully difficult. In the beginning, you fool around and you may or may not get the Rubik's Cube to work, but even if you get it to work, you won't be able to do it again because you didn't have any theory. You were just doing whatever looked good and felt comfortable. Then you get an idea, well, I always have to turn this in this way, and when I get a certain number of things turned in a certain way, I can't turn that way again because that'll undo it. You develop a theory. You may be lucky and the theory works, but probably isn't going to work, and you're kind of tied to the theory. The theory becomes kind of a Procrustean bed into which you fit things. Ultimately, through processes which are too complicated for me to talk about since I never could solve Rubik's Cubes, you come up with a set of procedures which you are able to talk about explicitly. There are three or four things you have to do, you have to pay attention to. If you do this, even if something goes wrong, you can alter it another way. So you're explicit about it, it's conscious, you can put it into words, and it works quite reliably. Let me now use an example that Carmeloff Smith herself uses. It's a much simpler one. And what she encounters here is what she calls U-shaped curve, which is that in these developmental phenomena, you typically have a situation where young kids do better than middle-aged kids, and perhaps as well as older kids, but they proceed in an entirely different way. So in the particular example, I'm going to use the block balance example, the four-year-olds are as good as the eight-year-olds, but what the six-year-olds do, which leads to worse performance, is actually more sophisticated and eventually allows a performance by eight-year-olds which is qualitatively different from the four-year-olds. So what does Carmeloff Smith do? She has a beam on which kids are asked to balance various shaped pieces. And unbeknownst to the kids, and what makes this difficult, is the pieces are actually asymmetrical in weight. So then rather than being even all the way across the board, they've got a hidden weight here, or a little bit closer to one side than the other. And so if you put the piece even on the board, it'll tilt because, in fact, it's asymmetrical, and you have to figure out where the extra weight is in order to get it to balance. So what do young kids do? They take the various blocks, they put them on the balance beam, and they just move it around until it works. And they do pretty well. The six-year-olds who are older don't. They have a theory. The theory is almost always, this has got to be symmetrical, and so I've got to put the thing exactly in the middle, otherwise it will tip one way or the other. Unfortunately, however, the theory doesn't work, and they are stymied. Let me read to you what Carmeloff Smith says about this. The six-year-olds treat negative feedback, that is, when a thing doesn't balance, as if the child were in difficulty, not as if the theory might be at fault. These children do exactly what Thomas Kuhn, who wrote about the structure of scientific revolutions, has argued that scientists do. They do not abandon or amend their theory despite glaring counterexamples. Instead, they look for an error in their behavior. When a weighted block placed at the geometric center falls, they put it right back at the geometric center, but very much more gently, as if it was the way they placed it which made it tilt. Finally, when the children can no longer treat the failure as an error in the behavior, they simply push aside any unevenly weighted blocks as impossible to balance, as an anomaly to be ignored. The observable data are brushed aside as irrelevant. So that's the six-year-old, so theory-driven, so top-down, if it doesn't work the way I think it's going to work, I'm stymied, that they don't do well as four-year-olds who are just busy fooling around until they get age thing to balance. The eight-year-old, on the other hand, figures out that some of these things are in the middle and they're going to balance just fine. Others aren't, and so you have to, on a case-by-case basis, figure out what's going to get each one to balance. And maybe they develop a theory that the long, thin ones have the weight on one side and the short, squat ones have the weight on the other side, but it's explicit, it's verbal, and they've gotten through the third phase. Their representational redescription is completely adequate for the task, and in most cases, they won't have to go any further. What's neat is that Carmeloff Smith discovers the same kinds of thing in language. The simplest example is past tense. Little kids say words like came and went, and words like kissed and loved, adding ed when appropriate and using the irregular past when appropriate. But the four-year-olds who have a rule add ed to everything. So it's not went, it's goed. It's not through, it's throwed, because they're following the theory to the letter, which is add ed to every past tense. And then, of course, the older kids realize that some words are irregular and other ones aren't, and so they don't make that kind of confusion. And so here you see, at a younger age, the same kinds of phases, which you see in a middle childhood with reference to blocks, and you see it with adults with references to things like the Rubik's Cube. The final thing I want to mention, which is just a placeholder, is that Annette Carmeloff Smith began to develop these ideas before computers were a factor at all in how we thought about cognition. Piaget would have loved the computational age if he'd lived long enough, but his work was really developed before computers were part of everybody's life. Then she had some interest in the early computer models which were developed for problem solving, ones which we'll talk about when we talk about the cognitive revolution. But recently she's become interested in what the newer forms of computer models, which we call connectionist models or neural network models, and she thinks that those provide the best explanation for the developmental phases which she's seen. One final point about Carmeloff Smith is, unlike both Piaget and Bruner, she says kids don't only advance when things don't work, they also advance when they do. Because when kids succeed at something, they want to know why they succeeded. They want to have a theory for it. They want to make it more explicit, more conscious, more verbal. And this drives our cognitive development at its later stages. I just want, in conclusion, to mention a few other things, so to speak, for extra credit. One of the writings of Harry Bailyn, one of the few American psychologist who, like Hans Firth, really understands Piaget. And he claims that Piaget himself went through a very heavy structuralist period in the middle of his life, but that in the early part of his life, when he was studying moral development and physical causality, he was more of a functionalist. And at the end of his life, when he was influenced by some of the Bruner-Inhelder interests, and when he also returned some of his early interests, he became more of a functionalist again, that's an interesting kind of claim. I think for Bruner, he's been a functionalist pretty much all the way through. And someone like Chomsky is a structuralist from beginning to end. Piaget, in the 1970s, when he was in his late 70s and early 80s, returned, as I said, to some of the classic issues and problems which he'd investigated as a young researcher, but did it in a much more technical way, much more philosophical way. He became interested in the nature of necessity, what has to happen, and how do children understand necessity, modality, the notion of possibility, what might happen and why. He developed further his theory of equilibration, which is the underlying mechanism which allows both progress and times of stasis. He wrote about children's consciousness, wonderful studies of when you have kids, ask kids to crawl, they crawl perfectly well. When you say to them, tell me how you crawl, and they have to become more reflective about things, a la Karmaloff Smith, this really stymies them. He looked more at content knowledge, what it actually meant to know something in a certain area, and actually used words like meaning and implication and signification. I myself have not mastered this work. Much of what was either not translated or has only been translated very recently, and therefore I don't have a strong feeling about it myself, but I would think that anything that Piaget worked on, even late in life, is worth further exploration. I hope some of you will be stimulated to do that, as I say here, for extra credit. Finally, having now spent a few weeks on Piaget and the Piagetian perspective, we should close by taking stock for a moment. We first looked at Piaget's numerous contributions throughout the area of genetic epistemology, including psychology and the study of different kinds of disciplines and the examination of all kinds of thinking in different content area from infancy all the way to adulthood. It's an amazing achievement, even for someone who lived into his 80s. I then contrasted Piaget with Brunner, who built not only on Piaget, but also on Vygotsky, who will be our next theorist, and on the American Darwin-Dewey tradition. Darwin, of course, wasn't American, but Darwin is the great adaptationist. Darwin looks at every behavior, every physical appearance, and says, why does it look this way? Why is the behavior unfolding this way? How does this allow survival in certain kinds of environments? And that's the question that Brunner and other people are interested in, tools and technology and schools. Tools, schools, and technology are always asking, what's it for? What's it going to be accomplished? If we did it this way, what would happen? Not issues that are as great importance to Piagetians and other structuralists. I mentioned some of the people who are most directly connected with the Piaget and Brunner traditions, students like Patricia Greenfield, David Olson, Michael Cull, and Sylvia Scribner, and some of the people who I myself have worked with, who've looked at the Piagetian problems in different kinds of cultural contexts, in school and unschooled environment, and with a particular emphasis on media, symbols, tools, technologies, other things which Piaget was kind of blind to because of his great interest in actions upon very simple objects. He didn't pay enough attention to the much more complex objects and ideas which individuals encounter in schooled environments. I also mentioned Geneva post-Piagetians. Berbel Inhelder survived Piaget for about 15 or 20 years, died recently, as did Mimi Sinclair. And then finally, Annette Karmaloff Smith, who I actually think is the most interesting of the post-Piagetian thinkers, still very active, takes a very measured position between the modularists and the anti-modularists, the domain specificists and the domain generalists, but has her own theory of phases of representational redescription, which she nicely shows manifest, whether it's infants trying to figure out how to balance something, or children learning how to speak language, or much older people who are mastering some kind of a complicated task. Next time, we look at what used to be called the Soviet school, but now that the Soviet Russia is at the end, it may get to be called the Russian school once again, the work of Lev Vygotsky and some of his closest associates.